My Lovely Wife by Samantha Downing. Read for you by David Pitu. 1. She is looking at me. Her blue eyes are glassy. They flicker down to her drink and back up. I look at my own drink and can feel her watching, wondering if I'm as interested as she is. I glance over and smile to show her I am. She smiles back. Most of her lipstick is gone, now a reddish smear on the rim of her glass. I walk over and take the seat next to her. She fluffs her hair. It is unremarkable in both color and length. Her lips move, she says hello, and her eyes are brighter. They look backlit. Physically, I appeal to her the same way I would appeal to most women in this bar. I am 39, in excellent shape, with a full head of hair and a deep set of dimples, and my suit fits better than any glove. That's why she looked at me, why she smiled, why she is happy I have come over to join her. I am the man she has in mind. I slide my phone across the bar toward her. It displays a message. Hello. My name is Tobias. She reads it and crinkles her brow, looking back and forth between the phone and me. I type another message. I am deaf. Her eyebrows shoot up. She covers her mouth with one hand, and the pink rises on her skin. Embarrassment looks the same on everyone. She shakes her head at me. Sorry, so sorry. She did not know. Of course you didn't. How could you? She smiles. It is not quite whole. I am no longer the picture in her head, no longer the man she imagined, but now she isn't sure what to do. She picks up my phone and types back. I'm Petra. A pleasure to meet you, Petra. You are Russian? My parents were. I nod and smile. She nods and smiles. I can see her mind churning. She would rather not stay with me. She wants to go find a man who can hear her laugh and does not have to type out his words. At the same time, her conscience tells her not to discriminate. Petra does not want to be the shallow woman who refuses a man because he is deaf. She doesn't want to turn me down the way so many others have, or so she assumes. Her internal battle is like a three-act play unfolding before my eyes, and I know how it ends, at least most of the time. She stays. Her first question is about my hearing, or lack of it. Yes, I have been deaf from birth. No, I have never heard anything. Not a laugh, not a voice, not a puppy barking, or a plane overhead. Petra gives me a sad face. She does not realize this is patronizing, and I don't tell her, because she is trying, because she stays. She asks if I can read lips. I nod. She starts to talk.
When I was 12, I broke my leg in two places. Bike accident.
Her mouth moves in the most exaggerated, grotesque way.
Anyway, I had to wear a cast that went from my foot all the way up to my thigh.
She stops, draws a line across her thigh in case I have trouble understanding. I don't, but I appreciate the attempt. And the thigh. She continues,
I couldn't walk at all for 6 weeks. At school, I had to use a wheelchair because the cast was too heavy for crutches.
I smile, half imagining little Petra with a big cast, half imagining where this sad story is heading.
I'm not saying I know what it's like to live in a wheelchair or to have any permanent disability. I just always feel like, well, it feels like I've had a small taste of what it would be like, you know?
I nod. She smiles with relief, afraid her story might have offended me. I type, You are very sensitive. She shrugs, beams at the compliment. We have another drink. I tell her a story that has nothing to do with being deaf. I tell her about my childhood pet, a frog named Sherman. He was a bullfrog who sat on the biggest rock in the pond and hogged all the flies. I never tried to catch Sherman. I would just watch him, and sometimes he watched me, too. We liked to sit together, and I started calling him my pet.
What happened to him?
Petra asks. I shrug. One day the rock was empty. Never saw him again. Petra says this is sad. I tell her it isn't. Sad would have been finding his dead body and being forced to bury him. I never had to do that. I just imagined he went to a bigger pond with more flies. She likes this and tells me so. I do not tell her everything about Sherman. For instance, he had a long tongue that darted around so fast I could hardly see it, but I always wanted to grab it. I used to sit by the pond and wonder how bad of a thought that was. How terrible was it to try and grab a frog's tongue, and would it hurt him? If he died, would it be murder? I never tried to grab his tongue, and probably couldn't have anyway, but I thought about it. And that made me feel like I wasn't a good friend to Sherman. Petra tells me about her cat, Lionel, who is named after her childhood cat, also named Lionel. I tell her that's funny, but I'm not sure it is. She shows me pictures. Lionel is a tuxedo cat with a face divided between black and white. He is too stark to be cute. She continues to talk and shifts to her work. She brands products and companies, and she says it's both the easiest and the most difficult thing. Difficult in the beginning because it's so hard to get anyone to remember anything, but as more people start to recognize a brand, it becomes easy.
At some point, it doesn't even matter what we're selling. The brand becomes more important than the product.
She points to my phone and asks if I bought it because of the name or because I like the phone. Both? She smiles.
See? You aren't even sure.
I guess not.
What do you do?
Accountant. She nods. It is the least exciting profession in the world, but it is solid, stable, and something a deaf guy can easily do. Numbers don't speak with a voice. The bartender comes over. He is neat and clean, college-aged. Petra takes charge of the ordering, and it is because I am deaf. Women always think I need to be taken care of. They like to do things for me because they think I am weak. Petra secures us two more drinks and a fresh bowl of snacks, and she smiles like she is proud of herself. It makes me laugh, silently, but still a laugh. She leans toward me and puts her hand on my arm, leaves it there. She has forgotten I am not her ideal man, and our progression is now predictable. It's not long before we go to her place. The decision is easier than it should be, though not because I find her particularly attractive. It is the choice. She gives me the power to decide. And right now, I am a man who says yes. Petra lives downtown, close to the bar, in the middle of all the big branding signs. Her place is not as neat as I'd expected. There's clutter everywhere, papers and clothes and dishes. It makes me think she loses her keys a lot.
Lionel is around here somewhere, hiding probably.
I don't look for that stark cat. She flits around, dropping her bag in one place and removing her shoes in another. Two glasses appear, filled with red wine, and she leads me into the bedroom. She turns to face me, smiling. Petra has become more attractive. Even her plain hair seems to sparkle. It is the alcohol, yes, but it's also her happiness. I get the feeling she has not been this happy in a while, and I'm not sure why. Petra is attractive enough. She presses up against me, her body warm, her breath soaked in wine. She takes the glass out of my hand and puts it down. I do not finish drinking it until much later, when we are in the dark and the only light is from my phone. We type back and forth, making fun of ourselves and the fact that we do not know each other. I ask, favorite color?
Lime green. Ice cream?
Bubble gum.
Bubble gum? The blue stuff?
Yes.
Who says that?
What's your favorite?
French vanilla. Pizza topping?
Ham.
We're done here.
Are we?
Wait, are we still talking about pizza?
We are not talking about pizza. Afterward, she dozes off first. I think about leaving, then about staying, and the idea bounces around so long, I doze off. When I wake up, it's still dark. I slip out of the bed without waking Petra. She is sleeping face down, one leg askew and her hair spread out on the pillow. I cannot decide if I really like her or not, so I don't decide at all. I do not have to. On the nightstand, her earrings. They are made of colored glass, a swirl of blue shades, and they look like her eyes. After getting dressed, I slip the earrings into my pocket. I take them to remind myself not to do this again. I almost believe it will work. I walk toward the front door without looking back.
Are you really deaf?
She says it out loud, to my back. I hear her, because I am not deaf. And I keep moving. I pretend I don't hear her, go straight to the door, and shut it behind me, then continue until I am out of her building, down the block, and around the corner. It is only then that I stop and wonder how she figured it out. I must have slipped. 2. My name is not Tobias. I use that name only when I want someone to remember me. In this case, the bartender. I introduced myself and typed out my name when I first walked in and ordered a drink. He will remember me. He will remember that Tobias is the deaf man who left the bar with a woman he just met. The name was for his benefit, not Petra's. She will remember me anyway, because how many deaf guys could she have slept with? And if I hadn't made a mistake, I would have been an odd footnote in her sexual history. But now she will remember me as the fake deaf guy, or the possibly fake deaf guy. The more I think about it, the more I wonder if I slipped twice. Maybe I froze when she asked if I was deaf. It's possible because that's what people do when they hear something unexpected. And if I did, she probably saw it. She probably knows I lied. On the drive back home, everything is uncomfortable. My car seat feels scratchy and it hurts my back. Everything on the radio is too loud, almost like everyone is screeching. But I can't blame that all on Petra. I have been irritable for a while now. At home, all is quiet. My wife, Millicent, is still in bed. I have been married to her for 15 years, and she does not call me Tobias. We have two kids. Rory is 14, and Jenna is 1 year younger. Our bedroom is dark, but I can just about see the shape of Millicent under the bed covers. I take off my shoes and tiptoe toward the bathroom. Well? Millicent sounds wide awake. I half turn and see the shadow of her propped up on an elbow. There it is again. The choice. From Millicent, a rarity. No, I say.
No?
She isn't right. The air between us freezes. It doesn't thaw until Millicent exhales and lays her head back down. She gets up before I do. By the time I walk into the kitchen, Millicent is organizing breakfast, school lunches, the day, our lives. I know I should tell her about Petra. Not about the sex, I wouldn't tell my wife about that. But I should tell her that I made a mistake, and that Petra is right for us. I should do it because it's a risk to leave Petra out there. Instead, I say nothing. Millicent looks at me, her disappointment hitting like a physical force. Her eyes are green, many shades of green, and they look like camouflage. They are nothing like Petra's. Millicent and Petra have nothing in common except they've both slept with me, or some version of me. The kids tumble down the stairs, already yelling at each other, fighting over who said what about so-and-so at school yesterday. They are dressed and ready for school, just as I am dressed for work in my tennis whites. I am not and never have been an accountant. While my kids are in school and my wife is selling houses, I am outside on the court in the sun, teaching people how to play tennis. Most of my clients are middle-aged and out of shape, with too much money and time. Occasionally, I am hired by parents who believe their child is a prodigy, a champion, a future role model. So far, they have all been wrong. But before I can leave to teach anyone anything, Millicent makes us all sit together for at least 5 minutes. She calls it breakfast. Jenna rolls her eyes, taps her feet, anxious to get her phone back. No phones are allowed at the table. Rory is calmer than his sister. He makes the most of our 5 minutes by eating as much as possible, then stuffing his pockets with whatever doesn't fit in his mouth. Millicent sits across from me, a cup of coffee perched at her lips. She is dressed for work in a skirt, blouse, and heels, and her red hair is pulled back. The morning sun makes it look like copper. We are the same age, but she looks better. Always has. She is the woman I should not have been able to get. My daughter taps my arm in a pattern like the beat to a song, and she continues until I pay attention to her. Jenna does not look like her mother. Her eyes, her hair, and the shape of her face come from me, and sometimes this makes me sad. Other times not.
"Dad, can you take me to get new shoes today?"
she says. She is smiling because she knows I will say yes. "Yes," I say. Millicent kicks me under the table.
"Those shoes are a month old," she says to Jenna. "But they're too tight now."
Not even my wife can argue with that. Rory asks if he can go play his video game for a few minutes before school.
"No,"
Millicent says. He looks at me. I should say no, but now I can't, not after I said yes to his sister. He knows this because Rory is the smart one. He is also the one who looks like Millicent. "Go ahead," I say. He races off. Millicent slams down her coffee cup. Jenna picks up her phone. We are done with breakfast. Before getting up from the table, Millicent glares at me. She looks exactly like my wife, and at the same time, nothing like her. I first saw Millicent in an airport. I was 22 and on my way back from Cambodia, where I had spent the summer with three friends. We got high every day and drunk every night, and we never shaved. I left the country as a clean-cut kid from the suburbs and returned as a shaggy, bearded man with a deep tan and some great stories. None compare to Millicent. I was on a layover, my first, back in the country. I went through customs and was heading to the domestic terminal when I saw her. Millicent was sitting in an empty gate area, alone, with her feet propped up on her suitcase. She was staring out of the floor-to-ceiling windows overlooking the tarmac. Her red hair was knotted into a loose bun, and she was wearing a t-shirt, jeans, and sneakers. I stopped to watch her as she watched the planes. It was the way she looked out the window. I had done the same thing when I set off on my trip. My dream had been to travel, to see places like Thailand and Cambodia and Vietnam, and I did. Now I was back on familiar ground, back to where I had grown up. But my parents were gone, although I am not sure they were ever really there. Not for me. When I returned, my dream of traveling had been fulfilled, but not replaced with another. Not until I saw Millicent. She looked like she was just beginning her own dream. In that moment, I wanted to be a part of it. At the time, I didn't think of all this. I came up with it later, when I tried to explain to her or anyone else why I found her so attractive. But back then, I continued to my next gate. After traveling for 20 hours with still more to go, I couldn't even muster up the energy to speak to her. All I could do was admire. It turned out we were on the same flight. I took it as a sign. She had a window seat, and mine was in the center of the middle row. It took a little convincing, some flirting with a flight attendant and a $20 bill, to get my seat moved next to Millicent. She did not look up when I sat down. By the time the drink cart came by, I had come up with a plan. I would order whatever she ordered, and, because I had already decided she was special, I could not imagine her ordering anything as mundane as water. It would be something more unusual, like pineapple juice with ice. And when I ordered the same thing, we would have a moment of symmetry, symbiosis, serendipity. It didn't matter what. Given how long it had been since I had slept, this plan sounded plausible in my head right up until Millicent told the flight attendant thanks, but no thanks. She did not want a drink. I said the same thing. It didn't have the effect I wanted. But when Millicent turned to the flight attendant,
I saw her eyes for the first time. The color reminded me of the lush, open fields I had seen all over Cambodia. They were not nearly as dark as they look now. She went back to staring out the window. I went back to staring at her while pretending I wasn't. I told myself I was an idiot and I should just talk to her. I told myself there was something wrong with me, because normal people didn't act like this over a girl they had never seen before. I told myself not to be a stalker. I told myself she was too beautiful for me. With 30 minutes left on the flight, I spoke.
Hi.
She turned, stared.
Hi.
I think that's when I stopped holding my breath. Years passed before I asked why she kept staring out the windows, both in the airport and on the plane. She said it was because she had never flown before. The only thing she had been dreaming about was a safe landing.
3. Petra was number one on the list. But now that she's been eliminated, I move on to the next, a young woman named Naomi George. I haven't spoken to her yet. In the evening, I drive to the Lancaster Hotel. Naomi works as a front desk clerk at the Lancaster, one of those old world places that survives because of its past glory. The building is huge and so grand in decor it could never be built today. It would be too expensive to do right and too cheesy if done wrong. The front of the hotel has glass doors and side panels offering a good view of the front desk. Naomi stands behind it, wearing the Lancaster uniform, a blue skirt and jacket, both trimmed in gold braid, and a crisp white blouse. She has long, dark hair, and the freckles on her nose make her look younger than she is. Naomi is 27. She probably still gets carded in bars, but is not as innocent as she looks. Late at night, I have seen her get a little too friendly with more than one male guest. They have all been alone, older, and well-dressed, and she doesn't always leave the hotel when her shift ends. Either Naomi has been making extra money on the side, or she has aspirational one-night stands. Because of social media, I know that her favorite food is sushi, but she won't eat red meat. In high school, she played volleyball and had a boyfriend named Adam. Now he is referred to as the Cretan. Her last boyfriend, Jason, moved away 3 months ago, and she's been single ever since. Naomi has been thinking about getting a pet, probably a cat, but she hasn't yet. She has more than 1,000 online friends, but from what I can tell, Naomi has just 2 close friends, 3 at the most. I'm still not sure she is the one. I need to know more. Millicent is tired of waiting. Last night I found Millicent in our bathroom, standing in front of the mirror, taking off her makeup. She was wearing jeans and a t-shirt proclaiming her the mother of a 7th grade honor student, Jenna, not Rory.
What was wrong with her?
She asked. Millicent does not use Petra's name because she does not have to. I know who she means. She just wasn't the one. Millicent didn't look at me in the mirror. She smoothed lotion on her face.
That's the second one you've eliminated. She has to be right, you know that.
She snapped the lid of her lotion bottle closed. I went to the bedroom and sat down to take off my shoes. The day had been long and needed to end, but Millicent wouldn't let it. She followed me into the bedroom and stood over me.
Are you sure you still want to do this?
She asked.
Yes.
I was too busy feeling guilty about sleeping with another woman to show much enthusiasm. It had hit me in the afternoon when I saw a little old couple. They had to be at least 90 years old, and they held hands as they walked down the street. Couples like that didn't cheat on each other. I looked up at Millicent and wished I could make us become like that. Millicent knelt in front of me and placed a hand on top of my knee.
We need to do this.
Her eyes flickered, the warmth from her hand spreading as it inched up my leg.
You're right,
I said.
We do need this.
She leaned closer and kissed me long and deep. It made me feel guiltier, and it made me want to do whatever will make her happy. Less than 24 hours later, I am sitting in front of the Lancaster Hotel.
Naomi's shift does not end until 11, and I cannot just sit outside the hotel for the next 3 hours. Instead of going home, I get something to eat and then sit in a bar. It's a convenient place to go when there is nowhere else. The place I have chosen is half full, mostly with men who are alone. It's not as nice as the bar I was in with Petra. The cocktails cost half as much, and anyone wearing a suit has already loosened their tie. The wood floor is patterned with scrapes from the bar stools, and watermark rings decorate the bar. This is a place for drinkers, by drinkers, a place where everyone is too inebriated for details. I order a beer and watch a baseball game on one screen and the news on another. Bottom of the third, two outs. Rain tomorrow, maybe, but then again it might be sunny. It is always sunny here in Woodview, Florida, a so-called enclave from the real world. In about an hour, we can be at the ocean, in a state park, or at one of the biggest amusement parks in the world. We always say how lucky we are to live here in Central Florida, especially those of us who live in the Hidden Oaks subdivision. The Oaks are an enclave from the enclave. Top of the fourth inning, one out. Still two more hours until Naomi's shift ends, and I can follow her. And then, Lindsay. Her smiling face stares at me from the TV screen. Lindsay, with her narrow brown eyes and straight blonde hair, her outdoorsy tan, and big white teeth. She went missing a year ago. For a week, she was a blip on the news, and then the story was gone. Without any close family to keep her on TV, no one paid attention. Lindsay wasn't a missing child. She wasn't defenseless. She was a grown woman, and in less than 7 days, she was forgotten. Not by me. I still remember her laugh. It was infectious enough to make me laugh along with her. Seeing her again makes me remember how much I liked her. 4. I first spoke to Lindsay while on a hike. One Saturday morning, I followed her to the hilly trails just outside town. She started on one trail, I started on another, and an hour later, we ran into each other. When she saw me, Lindsay nodded and said hello in a way that did not invite further conversation. I waved and mouthed hello. Unconsciously, she gave me an odd look, and I handed her my phone to introduce myself. "Sorry, that probably looked strange. Hello, my name is Tobias. I am deaf." I watched her guard drop. She introduced herself. We talked, and then we sat down to drink some water, and she offered me a snack. Pixie sticks. She had a handful of them. Lindsay rolled her eyes at herself. "That's terrible, right? Eating sugar while exercising? But I love them." "So do I." It was the truth. I hadn't eaten pixie sticks since I was a kid, but I loved them. She told me about herself, about the job, house, and hobbies I already knew about. I told her the same stories I told all of them. As the morning sun rose, we decided to finish our hike together. We were silent most of the way, and I liked it. My life was almost never silent. She declined my invitation to lunch, but we did exchange numbers. I gave her the number to the phone I use when I am Tobias. Lindsay texted me once, a few days after the hike. Hearing from her made me smile. "It was great to meet you last week. Hope we can hike together sometime." We did. A different trail the second time, farther north and near Indian Lake State Forest. She brought the pixie sticks again. I brought a blanket. We stopped to rest in an area where the sun was blocked by heavy foliage. As we sat down, I smiled at her, and it was real.
"You're cute," she said.
"No. You're the cute one." She texted a few days later, and I ignored it. By then, Millicent and I had agreed that Lindsay was the one. Now, a year later, Lindsay is back on TV. They found her. I go straight home from the bar. Millicent is already there, sitting on the front porch. She's still dressed in work clothes, and her patent leather pumps match the color of her skin. She says they make her legs look longer, and I agree. I always notice when she's wearing them, even now. After working all day and then being cooped up in the car watching Naomi, I realize how badly I need a shower. But Millicent doesn't even turn up her nose when I sit down next to her. Before I can speak, she does.
It's not a problem.
Are you sure? I ask.
Positive.
I do not know if this is true. We were supposed to take care of Lindsay together, but it didn't work out that way, and I don't have any options to argue with.
I don't understand how it's not a problem, she says again.
She points up, gesturing to the second floor of our house. The kids are home. I want to ask more, but I can't.
We have to wait on the next one, I say. We shouldn't do anything now.
She does not answer.
Millicent? I heard you.
I want to ask her if she understands, but I know she does. She just doesn't like it. She is upset Lindsay has been found now, right when we were planning another. It's like she has become addicted. She's not the only one. When I met Millicent on the plane, it wasn't love at first sight. Not for her. It wasn't even mild interest. After saying hello, she looked away and continued staring out the window. I was right back where I'd started. I leaned back on the headrest, closed my eyes, and berated myself for not having the courage to say more.
Excuse me.
My eyes flew open. She was looking at me, her green eyes huge, forehead wrinkled.
Are you okay? She said.
I nodded.
Are you sure?
I'm sure. I don't understand why you're...
Because you're knocking your head against this.
She pointed to the headrest.
You're shaking the seat.
I hadn't even realized I was doing it. I thought all that mental berating was just that, mental.
I'm sorry. So you're okay?
I recovered enough to realize the girl I had been staring at was now talking to me. She even looked concerned. I smiled.
I'm okay, really. I was just beating yourself up. I do the same thing.
About what? She shrugged.
Lots of things.
I felt an urge to know everything that made this girl beat her head in frustration, but the landing gear had just dropped and we didn't have time.
Tell me one, I said.
She considered my question, even putting her index finger up to her lips. I bit back another smile, not just because it was cute, but because I had her attention. After the plane landed, she answered.
Assholes, she said. Assholes on planes who hit on me when all I want is to be left alone.
Without thinking, without even realizing she was talking about me, I said, I can protect you from them. She stared at me, stunned. When she realized I was serious, she burst out laughing. When I realized why she was laughing, I did the same thing. By the time we walked up the jet bridge, we had not only introduced ourselves, we had exchanged phone numbers. Before walking away, she said,
How?
How what?
How would you protect me from all those assholes on planes?
I would force them into the center seat, hog the armrests, and give them paper cuts with the emergency information card. She laughed again, longer and harder than she had before. I'm still not tired of hearing her laugh. That conversation became part of us. The first Christmas we spent together, I gave her a huge box, big enough to fit a giant TV, all wrapped up and tied with a bow. The only thing inside was an emergency information card. Every Christmas since, we have tried to come up with the most creative reference to our inside joke. Once I gave her an underseat life jacket. Another time, she redecorated our tree with drop-down oxygen masks. Whenever I get on a plane and see that emergency card, I still smile. The strange thing is, if I had to pick a moment, the exact moment everything went into motion and brought us to where we are now, I would have to say it was because of a paper cut. It happened when Rory was 8 years old. He had friends, but not too many, a middle-of-the-road kid on the popularity scale, so it came as a surprise when a boy named Hunter gave Rory a paper cut. On purpose. They had been arguing about which superhero was strongest when Hunter got mad and cut Rory. The cut was in the crease between the thumb and index finger of his right hand. It was painful enough to make Rory scream. Hunter was sent home for the day, and Rory went to see the nurse, who bandaged his hand and gave him a sugar-free lollipop. The pain had already been forgotten. That night, after the kids were asleep, Millicent and I talked about the paper cut. We were in bed. She had just closed her laptop, and I turned off the TV. School had just started, and Millicent's summer tan hadn't completely faded. She didn't play tennis, but she loved to swim. Millicent picked up my hand and rubbed the thin stretch of skin between my thumb and index finger.
Have you ever had a cut here?
No. You?
Yes. Hurt like hell.
How did it happen?
Holly.
I knew very little about Holly. Millicent almost never talked about her older sister.
She cut you?
I asked.
We were making collages of all our favorite things, and we cut pictures out of magazines and pasted them all on big pieces of construction paper. Holly and I reached for the same piece at the same time, and
she shrugged.
I got cut.
Did you scream?
I don't remember, but I cried.
I picked up her hand and kissed the long-healed cut. What favorite things? I asked.
What?
You said you cut out pictures of your favorite things. What were they? Oh, no, she said, taking her hand back and turning out the light. You're not going to turn this into another crazy Christmas thing.
You don't like our crazy Christmas thing? I love it, but we don't need another.
I knew we didn't. I was trying to avoid the subject of Holly, because Millicent didn't like to talk about her. That's why I asked about her favorite things. I should have asked about Holly. 5. Lindsay dominates the news. She is the only one who has been found, and the first surprise is where her body is found. The last time I saw Lindsay, we were in the middle of nowhere. Millicent and I had taken her deep into the swamp near a nature preserve, hoping the wildlife would find her before any people did. Lindsay was still alive, and we were supposed to kill her together. That was the plan. That was the point. It didn't happen, because of Jenna. We had arranged for both kids to spend the night with friends. Rory was with a friend playing video games, and we had dropped Jenna off at a slumber party with half a dozen 12-year-old girls. When Millicent's phone went off, it sounded like a kitten. That was Jenna's ring. Millicent answered before the second meow.
Jenna? What's wrong?
I watched Millicent listen, my heart beating a little faster with each nod of her head. Lindsay was lying on the ground, her tanned legs sprawled out on the dirt. The drug we'd knocked her out with was wearing off, and she had started to move a little.
Honey, can you pass the phone to Mrs. Sheehan?
Millicent said. More nodding. When Millicent spoke again, her voice had changed.
I understand. Thank you so much. I'll be right there.
She hung up.
What? Jenna's sick. A stomach flu or maybe food poisoning. She's been in the bathroom for the past hour.
Before I could answer, she said,
I'll go.
I shook my head. I'll do it. Millicent didn't protest. She looked down at Lindsay and back at me.
But
I'll do it, I said. I'll pick up Jenna and take her home.
I can take care of her.
Millicent was looking down at Lindsay. She was not talking about our daughter.
Of course you can.
I never had a doubt. I was just disappointed I had to miss it. When I arrived at the Sheehan's, Jenna was still sick. On the way home, I pulled over twice so she could throw up. I sat up with her most of the night. Millicent returned home just before dawn. I didn't ask if she had moved Lindsay because I assumed she had buried her in that deserted area. I have no idea how she ended up in room number 18 at the Moonlight Motor Inn. The Moonlight closed when the new highway was built more than 20 years ago. The motel was abandoned and left to the elements, rodents, transients, and drug addicts. No one paid attention to it because no one had to drive by it.
Lindsay was found by some teenagers who called the police. The motel is a single strip of a building, one story with rooms lining both sides. Room 18 is on the backside, in the corner, and not visible from the road. As I watch aerial video of the motel on TV, I try to imagine Millicent driving around the back of the moonlight and parking, getting out of the car, opening the trunk, dragging Lindsay across the ground. I wonder if she is strong enough to do that. Lindsay was quite muscular from all those outdoor sports. Maybe Millicent used something to transport Lindsay, a cart, something with wheels. She is smart enough to do something like that. The reporter is young and earnest. He speaks as if every word is important. He tells me that Lindsay had been wrapped in plastic, shoved into the closet, and covered with a blanket. The teenagers discovered her because they had been playing a drunken game of hide and seek. I don't know how long she has been in the closet, but the reporter does say Lindsay's body was initially identified with dental records. The DNA tests are pending. The police could not use fingerprints because Lindsay's had been filed off. I try not to imagine how Millicent did this, or that she did it at all, but it becomes the only thing I can imagine. The images in my mind stay there, still frames of Lindsay's smiling face, of her white teeth, of my wife filing away Lindsay's fingertips, of her dragging Lindsay's body into a motel room and shoving her in the closet. These all flash through my mind throughout the day, the evening, and as I try to go to sleep. Millicent, however, looks normal. She looks the same when she gets home from work and throws together a salad, when she takes off her makeup, when she works on her computer before going to sleep. If she has been listening to the news, it doesn't show. A half dozen times, I start to ask her why or how Lindsay got into that motel. I don't, because all I can think about is why I have to ask, why she didn't tell me. The next day, she calls me in the middle of the afternoon, and the question is on the tip of my tongue. I am also starting to wonder if there is anything else I don't know. "Remember," she says, "we have dinner with the Prestons tonight." I remember. I do not remember. She knows this and tells me the name of the restaurant without my asking.
7 o'clock, she says.
"I'll meet you there." Andy and Trista Preston bought their house from Millicent. Although Andy is a few years older than me, I've known him forever. He grew up in Hidden Oaks. We went to the same schools, and our parents knew one another. Now he works at a software firm, making enough money to take tennis lessons every day, but he doesn't. That's why he has a paunch. But his wife takes lessons. Trista also grew up around here, but she's from the other part of Woodview, not the Oaks. We meet twice a week, and she spends the rest of her time working at an art gallery. Together, the Prestons make twice what we do. Millicent knows how much all of her clients make, and most earn more than us. I have to admit that this bothers me more than it bothers her. Millicent thinks it's because she makes more money than I do. She's wrong. It's because Andy makes more money than I do, though I do not tell her that. She is not from the Oaks. She doesn't understand what it's like to grow up here and then end up working here. Our dinner is at an upscale restaurant where everyone eats salad, chicken, or salmon, and drinks red wine. Andy and Trista drink the whole bottle. Millicent doesn't really drink, and hates it when I do. I don't drink around her.
"I envy you," Trista says to me. "I would love to have your job and be outside all day. I love playing tennis."
Andy laughs. His cheeks are red. "But you work in an art gallery. It's practically the same thing." "Being outside all day and working outside all day are two different things," I say. "I'd love to sit around on the beach all day, doing nothing." Trista scrunches up her pert nose.
"I think that would be boring, just lying around like that. I'd rather be doing something."
I want to tell her that taking a tennis lesson and teaching them are two different things. At work, the great outdoors is the last thing on my mind. Most of my time is spent trying to teach tennis to people who would rather be on their phone, watching TV, getting drunk, or eating. I don't need even one finger to count the number of people who really want to play tennis, much less exercise. Trista is one of them.
She doesn't really love tennis. She loves to look good. But I keep my mouth shut because that's what friends do. We don't point out each other's faults unless asked. The talk shifts to Andy's work, and I tune it out, catching only key words because I am distracted by the sound of silverware. Every time Millicent cuts a piece of grilled chicken, I think about her killing Lindsay.
"Attention," Andy says. "That's the only thing software companies care about. How can we get your attention, and how can we keep it? How can we make you sit in front of your computer all day?"
I roll my eyes. When Andy drinks, he tends to pontificate or lecture.
"Come on," he says, "answer the question. What keeps you in front of the computer?"
"Cat videos," I say. Trista giggles.
"Don't be a dick," Andy says.
"Sex," Millicent says. "It has to be either sex or violence."
"Or both," I say. "Actually, it doesn't have to contain sex," says Andy. "Not actual sex. What's necessary is the promise of sex, or violence, or both. And a storyline. You have to have a storyline. Doesn't matter if it's real or fake or who's telling it, you just need people to care what happens next."
"And how do you do that?" Millicent asks. He smiles and draws an invisible circle with his index finger.
"Sex and violence."
"That goes for everything, though. Even the news is built on sex and violence," I say.
"The whole world turns on sex and violence," says Andy.
He draws the circle with his finger again and turns to me.
"You know that. You're from here."
"I do know. Officially, the Oaks is one of the safest communities in the state. That's because all the violence is behind closed doors."
"I know that, too," Trista says to her husband. "Woodview isn't that different."
It is, but Andy doesn't argue. Instead, he leans over and gives his wife a peck on the lips. As their lips touch, she touches his cheek with her palm. I am jealous. Jealous of their simple conversations. Jealous of their heavy drinking. Jealous of their simple foreplay and the sex they will have tonight.
"I think we all get it," I say.
Andy winks at me. I glance over at Millicent, who is staring at her food. She thinks public displays of affection are distasteful. When the check arrives, both Millicent and Trista leave the table and go to the restroom. Andy grabs the check before I can.
"Don't bother protesting. I got it," he says, looking over the bill. "You guys are cheap dates anyway. No alcohol."
I shrug. "So we don't drink much." Andy shakes his head and smiles. "What?" I say.
"If I had known you were going to end up such a boring family man, I would have made you stay in Cambodia a lot longer."
I roll my eyes.
"Now you're the one being a dick," I say. "That's what I'm here for."
Before I can respond, our wives return to the table and we stop talking about drinking and about the check. The four of us walk out together and say our goodbyes in the parking lot. Trista says she will see me at her next lesson. Andy says he'll start soon. Trista is behind him, rolling her eyes and smiling. They drive off, leaving Millicent and me alone. We have two cars because we met at the restaurant. She turns to me. Under the streetlights, she looks as old as I've ever seen her.
"You okay?"
she says. I shrug. "I'm okay." I do not have any other option.
"You worry too much," she says, staring out over the sea of cars. "Everything is fine."
"I hope so."
"Trust me."
Millicent reaches out and slips her hand into mine, squeezes it. I nod and get into my car, but I don't go straight home. Instead, I drive by the Lancaster Hotel. Naomi is behind the front desk. Her dark hair falls loose around her shoulders, and although I can't see the freckles on her nose, I think I can. I am relieved to see her, to know that she is still working behind the front desk and probably still engaging in her extracurricular activities. There is no reason for me to think anything has happened to her because we have agreed to wait. Checking on Naomi is irrational, but I do it anyway. This is not the first time I have been irrational. Ever since they found Lindsay, I have not slept well. I wake up in the middle of the night, my heart pounding. and it is always about some irrational thing. Did I lock the front door? Are those bills paid? Did I remember to do all the little things I'm supposed to do so the house won't burn down or get taken by the bank and the car won't crash because the brakes weren't checked on time? All these little things keep my mind off Lindsay, and the fact that I cannot do anything about her now. 6. Saturday morning, Jenna's soccer game. I am alone because Millicent has to show a house. Saturday is the biggest day of the week for both real estate and tennis lessons. It is also the biggest day of the week for our kids' activities. Millicent and I trade off Saturdays with the kids, and the last time we were all together was more than a year ago when Rory went to the finals in a preteen golf tournament. He is playing golf now. I dropped him off early this morning before his sister's game started, and he is at the same club where I teach tennis. He plays golf because it is not tennis, and I hate that just as much as he wants me to. So far, Jenna has not displayed any of the same rebelliousness. She does not try to be difficult. Jenna does something because she wants to, not because it will make someone else angry, and I admire that quality in her. She also smiles a lot, which makes me smile back and then give her everything she wants. I have no idea what I am missing, and because I can't figure it out, Jenna scares the hell out of me. Soccer is not my game. I learned the rules only when Jenna started to play, so I am not much help. I cannot tell her what to do or how to do better like I could if she played tennis. It's only by some stroke of luck that she plays goalie, so at least I know her job is to keep the other team from scoring. Beyond that, all I can do is encourage her. You can do it. Nice job. Great effort. I often wonder if I'm embarrassing her. I think so, but I do it anyway because my only other option is to watch her games in silence. That seems cruel. I would rather be embarrassing. When she blocks the ball from going in the net, I lose my mind. She smiles but waves her hand, telling me to shut up. In these moments, I do not think about anything but my daughter and her soccer game. Millicent interrupts by sending a text. Don't worry. This is all she says. On the field, the kids are yelling. The other team tries to score, and my daughter has to block the ball again. She misses. Jenna turns around, her back to me, hands on hips. I want to tell her it's no big thing. Everyone makes mistakes, but that would be exactly the wrong thing. All parents say that, and all kids hate it. I did. Jenna looks straight down at the grass. A teammate walks up and pats her on the shoulder, says something. Jenna nods and smiles, and I wonder what her teammate said. I think it is the same thing I would have said, but it meant more. Play resumes. I look back down at my phone. Millicent has not said anything else. I pull up the news and gasp. The medical examiner's report states that Lindsay has been dead only a few weeks. Somewhere, somehow, Millicent kept her alive for almost a year. I have an urge to run. To where, I don't know. It doesn't matter. To do what? I have no idea. I just want to run anywhere. But I cannot leave Jenna here alone at a soccer game with no one to cheer for her. I cannot leave my daughter or my son. When Jenna's game is over, I pick Rory up at the club and the three of us have our usual post-sport pizza followed by frozen yogurt. It is difficult for me to stay with the conversation. They notice because they are my kids. They see me every day and know when something is wrong. This makes me wonder what they think about Millicent. Except she never looks like anything is wrong. For the past year, she's been calm, even for her. She'd mentioned finding the next woman a month ago. Everything falls into place. She didn't mention the next one until after she had killed Lindsay. For me, the past year had been filled with work, the kids' activities, chores around the house, arguing about bills, and getting the car washed. Nothing stood out. No single event, day, memory was anything I would remember 20, 30, or 40 years from now. Jenna's soccer team almost went to the city finals, but didn't. Millicent had another good year at work. Gas prices went up and then down. A local election came and went, and my favorite dry cleaner went out of business, and I had to find another. Or maybe the dry cleaner closed 2 years ago. It all runs together. During the same time, Millicent had been keeping Lindsay alive, holding her captive. The images running through my mind range from disturbing to barbaric. I envision the kinds of things I have heard about in the news when women are found after years of being held captive by some deranged man. I have never heard of a woman doing this, and as a man, I cannot imagine doing this myself. I leave the kids at home and drive to the open house where Millicent is working. It's just a few blocks from ours. The drive takes minutes. Two cars are out front, hers and one other, an SUV. I wait. 20 minutes later, she comes out of the house with a couple younger than us. The woman is wide-eyed. The man is smiling. As Millicent shakes their hand, she sees me out of the corner of her eye. I can feel her green eyes land on me, but she does not pause, does not break her fluid movement. The couple walk back to their car. Millicent stays in front of the house, watching them go. She is wearing navy blue today, a slim skirt and heels, and a pinstriped blouse. Her red hair is straight and cut sharp at her jawline. It was much longer when we met, and has grown shorter each year, as if she were committed to cutting off half an inch at regular intervals. It would not surprise me to learn that this is exactly what she has done. I am not sure anything about Millicent would surprise me now. She waits until the SUV is gone before turning to me. I get out of my car and walk up to the house.
"You're upset," she says.
I stare at her. She motions to the house.
"Let's go inside."
We go in. The entryway is huge. The ceiling is more than 20 feet high. New construction, just like ours, only this one is even bigger. Everything is open and airy, and it all leads to the great room, which is where we go.
"What did you do to her? For a year, what did you do?"
Millicent shakes her head. Her hair swings back and forth.
"We can't discuss this now."
"We have to. Not here. I have an appointment." She walks away from me, and I follow. A few months after we married, Millicent got pregnant. It was a surprise in some ways because we'd talked about waiting, but not completely. We were not always careful about using protection. We had discussed various methods of birth control, but always came back to condoms. Millicent did not like taking anything with hormones. They all made her too emotional. When Millicent was late, we both suspected she was pregnant. We confirmed it with a test at home and one at the doctor's office. Later that night, I could not sleep. We sat up for a long time, sitting on our secondhand couch in our run-down rented house. I curled up next to her, my head on her stomach, and I started worrying about everything.
"What if we screw it up?" I said.
"We won't.
We need money. How are we going?
We'll manage."
"I don't want to just manage. I want to prosper. I want..."
"We will."
I raised my head to look at her.
"Why are you so sure?"
"Why are you so unsure?"
"I'm not," I said. "I'm just
worried."
"Yes." She sighed and gently pushed my head back down to her stomach.
"Stop being silly," she said. "We'll be fine. We'll be better than fine."
Minutes earlier, I had felt more like a child than a soon-to-be father. She made me stronger. We have come a long way from those early days when we had no money. I had gone back to school to get my MBA, but I was halfway through when she got pregnant. We needed money, so I withdrew from the program and returned to what I know best, tennis. It was my one talent, the thing I could do better than anyone else I grew up with. The tennis court was where I shone, not bright enough to go pro, but bright enough to start offering private lessons. When I met Millicent, she had just finished a year of real estate classes and was studying to take the test. Once she passed, it took a while for her to start selling, but she did, even while pregnant, even when the kids were babies. And she was right. We made it work. We are better than fine. And as far as I know, we have not screwed up the kids yet. 7. Now, as we stand in that empty house she is trying to sell, Millicent does not make me feel stronger. She makes me feel scared.
It's not okay, I say. None of this is okay. She raises one eyebrow. That used to be cute.
Now you're growing a conscience? I always had. No, I don't think you did.
She is right again. I have never had a conscience when I'm trying to make her happy.
What did you do to her?
I ask.
It doesn't matter. She's gone.
Not anymore.
You worry too much. We're fine.
The doorbell rings.
Work calls, she says.
I walk with her to the door. She introduces me, tells them about my tennis skills. They are as young as the last couple and just as clueless. I head home and drive right by our house. First, I go to the Lancaster. Naomi is there behind the counter with many hours left on her shift. Next, I go by the country club. I think about distracting myself by hanging out in the clubhouse, chatting with some of my clients while watching sports. Again, I don't stop. A number of other places run through my mind. A bar, a park, the library, a movie. I burn through almost half a tank of gas driving around, trying to pick a destination, before I head toward the inevitable. Home. It is where I always go. When I open the door, I hear the sounds of my life, my family, the only real one I ever had. Rory is playing a video game, electronic gunshots ringing through the house. Jenna is on the phone, talking, texting, and setting the table. The smell of dinner wafts through the great room, chicken and garlic and something with cinnamon. Millicent is behind the counter, putting it all together, and she always hums to herself while fixing meals. Her song choice is usually something ridiculous, a show tune, an aria, the latest pop music. And that's another inside joke of ours. She looks up and smiles, and it is real. I see it in her eyes. We all sit down and eat together. Jenna entertains her mother and bores her brother with a play-by-play of her soccer game. Rory brags about his golf score, which today was better than anyone else under 16. On most days, our meals are like this. They are boisterous and loud, filled with tales of the day and the ease of us, we who have lived together forever. I wonder how many times we did this while Lindsay was being held captive. When I get into bed, I am surprised that hours have passed since I last thought about Lindsay, about the police, about what Millicent and I have done. Home and all that goes with it is that powerful to me. My childhood was not the same. While I did grow up in a two-parent family in our nice Hidden Oaks house with two cars, good schools, and a lot of extracurricular activities, we did not eat meals together like my own family does. And if we did happen to all eat at the same time, we ignored one another. My father read the paper, my mother stared off into space, and I ate as quickly as possible. They showed up to watch me play tennis only if I was in a tournament, and even then, only if I made it to the last round. Neither of my parents would have given up a Saturday for anything. Home was a place to sleep, a place to hold my stuff, a place to leave as soon as possible. And I did. I left the country as soon as I could. It was impossible to imagine an entire life of feeling like a disappointment. Though I am not sure it was me, not personally. If I had to guess, I was the one who was supposed to fix their marriage. After spending years thinking about it, running through my whole childhood again and again, I have come to the conclusion that my parents had me to try and fix their marriage. It didn't work, and their disappointment became my failure. I returned to Hidden Oaks only because my parents passed away. It was a freak accident, impossible to prevent or predict. They were driving down the highway, and a tire flew off a car ahead of them. It smashed through the front windshield of my father's luxury sedan, and they both died. Gone, just like that. Still together, still undoubtedly miserable. I never saw their bodies. The police said I wouldn't want to. It turned out my parents had far less money than they pretended to, so I came home to a house buried in mortgages and just enough money to pay an estate lawyer to settle everything and get rid of it. My parents weren't even who I thought they were. They were frauds. They couldn't afford to live in Hidden Oaks. They just pretended they could. I had no family left and didn't know what one was.
Millicent built ours. I say it was her because it couldn't have been me. I had no idea how to build a home or even how to get everyone together for a meal. She did. The first time Rory sat in a high chair, she pushed him up to the table, and we've been having meals together ever since. Despite the rising complaints from our growing kids, we still eat together. When Millicent was pregnant with Jenna, she created our family rules. I called them Millicent's Commandments. Breakfast and dinner together, always. No toys or phones at the table. Allowances must be earned by doing chores around the house. We will have movie night once a week. Sugar will be limited to fruit, not fruit juice, and special occasions. All food will be organic, as money allows. Physical activity and exercise are encouraged. No, they're mandatory. Homework must be done before TV or video games. The list made me laugh. She glared at me when I did laugh, though, so I stopped. By then, I knew the difference between when she was pretending to be mad and when her anger was genuine. One by one, Millicent instituted her rules. Instead of turning the house into a prison, she gave the family structure. Both our kids play sports. They aren't given money unless they work for it. We all sit down and watch a movie together once a week. They eat mostly organic and very few sugary foods. Their homework is always done by the time I get home from work. This is all because of Millicent. The same Millicent who kept Lindsay alive for a year while doing God knows what to her. I still cannot sleep. I get up and check on the kids. Rory is spread out on his bed, the covers thrown everywhere. When he turned 14, he no longer wanted dinosaurs painted on the walls. We redid the room, repainted it, refinished the furniture, and now it has one dark wall and three beige ones, a smattering of Rock Band posters, a dark stain on all the wooden furniture, and blackout curtains for when he sleeps. It looks like a child's idea of an adult room. My son is becoming a teenager. Jenna's room is still orange. She's been obsessed with the color almost since birth. I think it comes from the color of Millicent's hair. Jenna's hair is like mine, dark brown, with no sign of red. She has posters of female soccer players on her walls, along with a few musical groups and a male actor or two. I don't know who they are, but whenever they are on TV, Jenna and her friends squeal. Now that she has reached the mature age of 13, all her dolls have been stuffed into her closet. She is into fashion, jewelry, and makeup she is not allowed to wear yet, along with a few stuffed animals and video games. I walk around the house, checking all the doors and windows. I even go into the garage, looking for signs of rodents or bugs or water damage. I go out into the backyard and check the side gate. I do the same in the front yard, and then I go around the house again, relocking all the doors. Millicent used to do this, especially after Rory was born. We were living in the rundown rental, and every night she walked around locking all the doors and windows. She would sit down for a few minutes, then get up and do it all over again. "This isn't a dangerous neighborhood," I told her. "No one is going to break in." "I know." She got up again. Eventually, I decided to follow her. I fell in lockstep behind her and mimicked every move she made. First, I got the glare, the real one. When I didn't stop, she slapped me. "You're not funny," she said. I was too stunned to speak. I had never been slapped by a woman. I hadn't even been spanked, not even playfully. But since I had just mocked my wife, I threw up my hands and apologized. "You're only sorry because you got slapped," Millicent said. She whipped around, went into the bedroom, and locked the door. I spent the night thinking she was going to leave me. She was going to take my son and just go because I had ruined everything. Extreme, yes, but Millicent does not put up with shit, period. Once when we were dating, I said I would call her at a certain time, and I didn't. She didn't speak to me for more than a week, wouldn't even pick up the phone. She came back to me that time, but I had no doubt that if I pissed Millicent off enough, she would just leave. And one time she did. Rory was 1.5. Jenna was 6 months old, and Millicent and I spent all day, every day, juggling the kids and our jobs. One day, I woke up, exhausted again, and realized I was 27 years old with a wife, two kids, and a brand new mortgage. All I wanted was a break, a temporary reprieve from all that responsibility. I went out with the guys, and I got so drunk they had to carry me into the house. When I woke up the next day, Millicent was gone. She did not answer her phone. She was not at her office. Her parents said she was not with them. Millicent had only a few close friends, and none had heard from her. She had vanished, and she had taken my kids with her. After 3 or 4 days, I was calling her phone every hour. I emailed, I texted. I became the most insane version of myself I had ever been. It wasn't because I was worried about her. I knew she was fine, and I knew my children were fine. I went crazy because I thought they were gone forever. 8 days went by. Then she was back. I had fallen asleep late, sprawled out on the unmade bed littered with pizza boxes and assorted plates, cups, and random food packages. I woke up to a garbage-free bed and the smell of pancakes. Millicent was in the kitchen making breakfast. Rory was at the table in his high chair, and Jenna was in her bassinet. Millicent turned to me and smiled. It was real.
"Perfect timing," she said. "Breakfast is just about ready."
I ran over to Rory and picked him up, holding him high in the air until he squealed. I kissed Jenna, who stared up at me with her dark eyes. I sat down at the table, afraid to speak, afraid I was in a dream, and I didn't want to wake up. Millicent brought a full stack of pancakes over to the table. As she set them down, she leaned in close so that her mouth was right next to my ear, and she whispered, "We won't come back a second time." I have spent our entire marriage with no choice but to believe her. Yet I still slept with Petra and the other one.